No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I'm joined by my co-host, Kathleen Gomez, and together we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and that affect the lives of all of us. For the past several weeks, we have attempted to start a dialogue that may provide some answers and hopefully find some reasonable solutions to the escalating violence in our society. This is a complex problem, which is why we're dedicating several shows to trying to discuss all aspects of it. This is also why we want your input. If we could solve these problems alone, we would do it. But we understand that it will take all of us to stop the violence. So please call in and let us know how you feel about these issues. Today we're going to talk about guns, and we're lucky to have a very special guest who is an expert on the subject and an eloquent spokesman on gun violence, and that's Ladd Everett, Director of Communications for the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence here in Washington. Before we get started, let me introduce my co-host, Kathleen Gomez, who is joining us from the great state of Arizona. Hi, Kathleen. As always, thanks for helping get the conversation started.
Hello, Senator Brown, and of course, the audience. I'm Kathleen Gomez, and I'm here on the border of Arizona and Mexico this weekend, and welcome to Shadow Politics. Over the next 2 weeks, we want to have a conversation with America about guns, and we want this to be a discussion, not just me and Senator Brown talking back and forth to each other. So please call in with your opinion, and you know, we don't have to identify you. You can make up a name, but we do want to hear from you. So let me give you the number. It is 888-429-5471, or you can Skype us at BBS Radio 2. Talking about this issue is really important, and it's very divisive, and it's very emotional, and it's very complicated. So hearing from one side and not the other will never get us anywhere. So please call in and give us your input. Today we are glad to have Ladd Everett with us. Welcome to Shadow Politics, and thank you for being here, Ladd. How are you?
Thank you for having me. I'm doing great.
Well, let me start by asking you, you know, here in Arizona, and how this show started was because basically Michael and I were having big arguments on who should have guns and whether we should have guns. And I would explain to him that out here on the border or in rural Arizona, that it is a situation where people do need to be able to protect themselves. And a lot of people feel that the Second Amendment gives people the right to own a gun. And I mean, do you interpret it differently, or what is your answer to that? But people say, look, the Constitution gives us the right to have a gun.
Yeah, well, look, I think you have to go back and you have to actually look at the debates that our founders were having at the time that they drafted the Second Amendment and ratified the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. You know, none of that debate involved individual self-defense against criminals. 100% of that debate was about people, you know, at that time, of course, white men, who were actually serving in well-regulated state militia forces. And, you know, there was certainly a notion at that time about needing to protect against potential federal encroachment, federal tyranny. But, you know, the way it was laid out, including, you know, very beautifully by the author of the Second Amendment, James Madison, was that it would be state militia forces that would oppose any potential federal tyranny. And, you know, it would not be, in other words, lone wolves going around and, let's say, shooting elected officials as they saw fit, but well-regulated militia forces conducted by state governments and operating expressly under their authority. So it wasn't, you know, at that time in the way they discussed it, the debates were about things like, you know, should conscientious objectors be required to serve in the militia? Should the commander-in-chief, the president, be able to call state militia outside their borders? Because that at that time, the militia, obviously, there were no organized police forces. They served a variety of internal and external security functions. So with the Second Amendment, what Madison was trying to do was the Constitution had given the federal government, our Congress, a great deal of control over the state militia, basically allowing them to organize, train, and equip the militia. That scared a lot of state actors and anti-federalists, and with the Second Amendment, he was trying to rebalance that control to assure that the militia would be supplied by privately, individually held firearms, not armed by the federal government. At least that was the ideal for some time. As it turns out, you know, 200-plus years later, of course, now our well-regulated militia, which is our National Guard, is entirely supplied with arms by the federal government. No one buys an AR-15 at a gun show in Arizona and brings that out to serve in Iraq or anywhere else. And then the other thing that's obviously changed dramatically is no one fears, you know, a standing army in this country anymore. Our standing army is now enormous in a way our founders never would have envisioned, and they're the most trusted institution in our country.
Well,
yeah,
Let me just follow up on that. A lot of people out here especially have a feeling that they need to protect themselves from the federal government. There is a feeling that the National Registry is just a way to identify them, and they're going to be the first to be, you know, where the government will come down, knock down the doors, and take their guns. And, you know, I'm not necessarily saying I believe that, but it is a strong sentiment that people need to have the right to protect themselves from our federal government. I mean, what do you say to that kind of opinion?
I think it's very dangerous, and I think, you know, as someone speaking from the perspective of an Arizonan, I think you should, you know, understand that better than anyone else. We, of course, had a congresswoman shot in the head there by a very mentally unstable young man who wrote, and I quote, "You don't have to accept the Federalist laws." You know, he was someone that bought into what I would call a very virulent anti-government ideology. And you combine access to arms with a little mental instability and this insurrectionist ideology, and you have a very dangerous brew on your hands. You know, I don't believe it, you know, and the registration thing I think is kind of a ridiculous boogeyman. I'll give you a few examples. One is that Americans have been required to register fully automatic machine guns since the 1930s. And unless I missed a headline somewhere, I don't think there's been any confiscation of those types of weapons, even though there's more than 500,000 in private hands today. There are also states across the country that require licensing and registration for handguns. And again, unless I missed a news bulletin somewhere, I've never heard of any effort to forcibly confiscate those guns from law-abiding citizens. What licensing and registration laws do, and they do beautifully well, is ensure that the people who go through that process obey the laws, not just in a wink-wink way, but truly obey the laws. Those guns don't end up on crime scenes because they can't be transferred without accountability. People know that if they've registered a firearm and the police recover that on a crime scene, they're going to have some serious questions to answer, and they're not going to be able to walk away if they have the wrong answers.
Well, you know, I've got to say, lad, that I think it's all a lot of it's boogeyman. You know, I've always wondered why the Second Amendment, all the focus seems to be on the words "shall not be infringed" rather than the first four words of the Second Amendment, which is a well-regulated militia. You know, isn't that really what we're trying to do? We're not trying to take guns away, as far as I can see. We're trying to regulate them the way we regulate other dangerous things in our society. And you know what? No, my car's been registered for a long time, and nobody ever tried to take it away. It's also been insured. What do you think about requiring people to have insurance that own guns?
Well, look, I think there's a lot of different things we can talk about in terms of how we need to better regulate firearms. I think, you know, the conversation needs to start with let's make sure we have a background check on every firearm. You know, right now in 40-plus states, you can buy guns through private sales without any background checks whatsoever. So, Yeah, we've got a lot of talking to do and a long road to go before we're doing really just common sense things to prevent people like Jared Loughner or Aaron Alexis from legally buying guns. I mean, I think we need to realize that a lot of these mass shooters who had a zillion red flags and everyone knew they were dangerous, a lot of these guys are quote-unquote law-abiding gun owners. They legally buy guns because our laws are so weak. So, you know, there's many things we can be doing. And you know, I think, you know, faced with that reality, I think the NRA, in order to continue to raise money and increase their power, and their intimately tied with the gun industry. That's how they make their money. You know, they need to gin up fears and convince people that regulation of firearms is an all or nothing proposition, right? You know, right. There's no issue in American history where we regulate it all or nothing. We always meet somewhere in the middle and we compromise and we come out with good policy, but the NRA can't win those types of debates. The NRA has to win a debate that either we're not going to regulate guns at all, or this fantasy that's never materialized in 200 plus years that the government's coming to forcibly confiscate guns and start a war with citizens, which is never going to happen.
Well, and there's no amendment to the Constitution which isn't limited. I mean, it seems to me only the Second Amendment, you know, the First Amendment, you can't yell fire in a crowded theater. There's no amendment to the Constitution that doesn't have limits. So that bothers
me too.
Absolutely.
Well, and to that point, There were gun laws, of course, in the time of our founders. You know, there were many laws dating back hundreds of years where you weren't able to carry pistols into certain municipalities or towns and things along those lines, or you couldn't store gunpowder in certain areas because it prevented a public safety threat. So there's all those kinds of laws that are in our history. And, you know, I think our founders, in terms of things like, you know, should a guy be able to buy a handgun or a pistol, I think to them that was very much a matter of common law and not constitutional law. Again, I think to properly understand the Second Amendment, I think it's critical to understand how integral to the society the militia was at that time. You know, there were no organized police forces at that time, so they handled internal security. You know, they fought in our nation's wars, you know, average citizen soldiers. You know, these were the type of units that were really a bedrock part of American society. In the way they existed now, they don't exist anymore. You know, again, there's no one going out and serving in the National Guard, you know, bringing out his AR-15. And even, you know, under federal statute, the unregulated militia, they've never been called up. There's no reason to call up a citizen soldier in our society because we have the world's most powerful military. You know, I'm sorry, Red Dawn might be a great movie, but sorry, folks, it ain't going to happen. You know, not
well, let me say this. Let me say this. Now, you know, you guys both live in Washington, D.C., a very urban area. I'm out here in rural Arizona, as you know. I went to school with Phil Krentz, his older brother. Rob was the one that was shot by, you know, the smugglers or whatever. We have a lot of, you know, drug trafficking. We have a lot of cartel activity on the border. And they are very, very well equipped. We're also very rural. So we might have three sheriffs that actually enforce law in a county that has 250,000 people and is probably bigger than, what is it, maybe Rhode Island. So in where I'm from, it's very, and I've stayed out of my sister's ranch, to tell you the truth. I mean, I've woken up to see people peering in her window. And it's a threat to my security. So is there a situation where in a location where you're rural, where there's no police force nearby, there's nobody who's going to come to help you, not even the Border Patrol, isn't that a situation where I have the right to protect myself?
Well, look, I have no issue with someone owning a firearm in the home for self-defense, and I would go even further and say that I don't think a rural area like you're talking about needs to have the same gun laws as, downtown Washington, D.C., or a crowded neighborhood in Washington, D.C. I think there should be a lot of room for individual jurisdictions to tailor their gun laws as needed. That said, I think our federal baseline is really dangerously low in this country. So, for example, you know, I have no problem with someone owning a firearm in the home in Arizona to defend themselves and their families if you make that personal choice that that's what's best for you. But I would like that person, when they buy a gun, to undergo a background check. I would like that background check to actually be a good one, a thorough one, where they actually do take a look at your mental health history, you know, see if you've been under restraining orders in the past, you know, things that are obvious indicators of a potential for violent behavior. We're not doing that now. So, you know, I again, the NRA is trying to force us into this kind of, like, absolutist, ridiculous discussion where it's all or nothing. It doesn't have to be all or nothing. I think a rural jurisdiction can have, you know, looser gun laws, if you will, than a city. And I think that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let me ask you, as a
yeah,
politician.
I mean, really, you know, there's I don't think there is a one-size-fits-all solution for this any more than there is for many other policy discussions that we have.
Let me ask you, lad, as a politician, this is particularly relevant to me, and that is what just happened in Colorado. You know, we're all afraid of the NRA. As you probably know, we tried to pass legislation to give the District of Columbia a vote, which breezed through the Senate when it was first put forth, but then after it passed the House and went back to the Senate during the next session, senators backed out because the National Rifle Association, who has a particular hatred of the District of Columbia for many reasons, not the least of which is its tough gun laws, tied a gun amendment, a lovely senator from Nevada named Ensign, tied a gun amendment to it, and a lot of relatively moderate Democrats like Mark Warner, who happens to be an old friend of Kathleen and mine, backed off because of a fear of the National Rifle Association. So what happened in Colorado with the two senators being recalled, the New York Times has called this a national referendum on guns. Do you think it is? And how do we change our strategy if it is?
Well, you know, a few observations on that. You know, number one, I don't think it's a national referendum on guns. I mean, I think you have to understand that in those recalls, we were talking about two, you know, relatively small jurisdictions with a low number of people voting. And voters in that in those elections had to contend with a federal judge ruling that prohibited mail-in ballots, which is basically, you know, a matter of course in Colorado. So, you know, there was a little bit of voter suppression going on there as well. So, no, I don't think it's a referendum. And, you know, one of those elections, John Morse's election, was a 300-vote difference. So,
right.
You know, I give the NRA credit. You know, they picked four races in Colorado, four recall races to go after. They couldn't get signatures for two. They got signatures for the two that they won. And they, you know, they did what they had to do. They picked low-hanging fruit. That said, you know, as one example, I would, you know, encourage you to look across the border right now into Virginia and see how guns is playing in those big races. You know,
yeah.
Terry McAuliffe is talking about gun reform constantly. Herring is. You know, this is not an issue that the, at least the Democratic candidates in those races are shying away from at all. So, you know, we might get to November and see what happens in Virginia, and we might be having a discussion about, you know, Virginia voters embrace Colorado-style gun control. So I think, you know, I think the NRA's kind of myth and their shadow has always been a little bit bigger than their real power is. I mean, they got absolutely decimated in the 2012 elections. You know, there was not a PAC that performed worse in the entire country than theirs. I mean, they got creamed in the presidential race. They lost like something like 7 out of 8 Senate races where they spent more than $100,000. So, you know, I think we try to simplify these pictures. I think this one is a little bit more complicated, but I would say this in terms of how we beat them. You know, I would say the gun violence prevention movement is now organizing in a way that is very political and that I think eventually will begin to beat down the political power of the NRA in a very real way. And that's by doing two things. Number one, by finally having the financing to be able to get involved in these campaigns, and between Mayor Bloomberg's Independence USA PAC and Gabby Gifford's new PAC, we can pretty much match them dollar for dollar. And, you know, we made the NRA spend a lot of money in those two little tiny races in Colorado to win them. I mean, we made them spend more than $500,000 there. You know, another way that we're doing it is by organizing on the ground. There's now a bigger grassroots gun violence prevention movement than certainly there ever has been since I've been doing this. I've been doing it for 13 years now. But, you know, with entirely new national organizations like Moms Demand Action, with Obama's post-campaign organization, OFA, now actively involved in the issue, and so many other progressive organizations that never really worked it. It's a brand new picture, and I'm not going to tell you right now tonight that we've totally closed the passion gap with people who are hardcore pro-gun activists, but we're closing it, and I'm confident we're going to get there.
Well, I would say that one of the things that your side needs to do more thoroughly is to talk about what you do feel or what would be allowable to you, or what you guys think that people who want to own guns can own guns. Because what I hear, you know, from all the groups is you can't have guns. So when you talked about...
Wait, let me stop you right there. When you say okay. You hear that from all the groups, what groups are you referring to?
I'm talking about whether it's Gabby Giffords group or whether it's all these different organizations that are fighting against, you know...
Not a single group in our movement is saying that. I have to correct you on that, Kathleen. Giffords and Mark Kelly are gun owners who on their tour have been going shooting.
Well, maybe right. It's true. They have gone shooting.
You're hearing it from Fox News and the NRA, and you know, it's you just people have to think. And you know, there's certain actors where taking their word for it isn't always the best policy.
Well, I think what you need to do is publicly put out there that you're not against all guns and that there are areas. But I guess where would I find that? As somebody who is
You're finding it right now. You asked to speak to me.
That's right. But yeah. That's what you have to do.
Have a conversation in your community with someone who is tired of seeing mass shooters legally buy guns and say to them, what can we do about this that's realistic, but I could still keep a firearm for self-defense?
Let me finish my question. My question is, for somebody who is really adamant in the fact that everyone is trying to take away my right to own my gun, and I get that a lot on my Facebook, what am I supposed to tell? Where do I tell them to go to see what the real facts of the other side is saying?
Challenge them. Well, first of all, challenge them. And if they're claiming what you just claimed, which is that all of our organizations are saying you can have no guns, ask for a citation. Say, okay, that's an interesting claim. Can you cite a primary source for that claim? Then they'll come back and they'll say, well, you know, they'll come back with some, I don't know what they'll come back with, some other conspiracy theory. Challenge that. You should challenge that kind of misinformation no matter what issue you get it on. And, you know, and if you need to encourage them to actually call me, have them call me, I'd be happy to talk to them.
So they could go to your site and they would actually see something written up that says that, you know, we're not an organization that is against all guns. You know, we do believe that you have the right to protect yourself if you choose that that's your right, but we do want to have stronger background checks. They would be able to easily find that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. I want to have stronger laws than just background checks. I think that's the most important piece of what we need to do. I think there's more than that. But, yeah, I mean, you know, the general notion, do I have a problem with someone owning a firearm in their home for, you know, defending their family? No. I have family and friends in my own life that do that, and I'm not trying to kick down their door and take their gun. I could, you know, that's their decision.
Well, you know, something that you mentioned, lad, which I think is right to the point, is the race in Virginia. Kathleen and I both worked with Terry McAuliffe for many years, and we know him personally. McAuliffe is a gun owner. McAuliffe is a hunter. As you say, he's talking about gun reform. And because of it, the NRA has last week announced that they're going to put in $500,000 against him in support of Cuccinelli because they don't like his stand on guns. And I find that really scary. And one thing I also find scary about the Colorado situation is that those people were talking about banning clips of 30. They weren't talking about taking away people's guns. They were talking about pretty minor changes in the law that got these people fired up. So that's what I would say to Kathleen, is that people on the other side are not looking at the facts. And maybe people on our side don't look as much at the facts as they should, but people on the other side don't look at the facts. Nobody was talking about taking away anybody's guns in Colorado, and nobody's talking about taking guns away in Virginia either.
I think the problem is that people don't trust the government, because so many times the government says they're going to do one way, and either the law gets changed, you know, and we know how it gets done on the Hill. You know, you think this one law passed and that's going to be it, only to find it gets different shades along the way by different politicians. So there is a real distrust of what politicians are going to say is going to happen, and people don't believe it. So, I mean, I kind of standing up for those people who really feel, I think they have a strong foundation to believe that way. There's not a lot of trust.
I don't know. I tend to look at the people who stoke that distrust the most, and, you know, they tend to be people that have a clear agenda to weaken government power, you know, whether it's to heighten corporate power or to, like, as with the NRA, to loosen basically regimes of regulation to the point where industry is operating without, you know, any restraint whatsoever. You know,
excuse me, Lad, but I think we need to see the National Rifle Association for what it is. The NRA is not a lobby group trying to save your personal rights. The NRA is a trade association. They're trying to sell more guns. That's what they do. You know, it seems to me that if the National Tobacco Institute were out there telling you that smoking was okay, you wouldn't believe it. Or if the National Sugar Council was out there saying that you can drink as much soda as you want and it would have no effect, you wouldn't believe it. But for some reason, the National Rifle Association, and I'll give them credit for this, they've managed to wrap themselves in an American flag and make themselves look like they're standing up for Americans' freedom, when I think what they're trying to do is sell guns. Is it not true, Lad, that they were for background checks at one time?
Well, I mean, kind of. I mean, if you go back to the period after Columbine, you know, at some point, the NRA, I think, you know, was thinking they were losing that battle in Congress, and they basically agreed to, certain legislation that would allow us to require background checks on private sales of firearms at gun shows. You know, I think now the NRA is thinking they can dig in once again and oppose basically anything. But, you know, your central premise is correct in that, you know, the NRA has gun industry executives that sit directly on its board of directors, you know, guys like, you know, Ronnie Barrett and Pete Brownell and all these guys. And they get millions of dollars every year through what they call their Ring of Freedom program in direct corporate contributions from the gun industry. Millions of dollars every year. So when the industry fares well, you know, guys like Wayne LaPierre get to pump up their $1 million per year salary. And that's what this is about. It's about money and power at the end of the day. So, no, it's not. It doesn't have a darn thing to do with freedom. I mean, I think anyone who's thinking correctly understands that, you know, when you reach a point where you can't even feel confident to walk down your street or bring your kid to school or go to church without being shot, you know, freedom has basically been eliminated altogether in this country. So, you know, that's the kind of freedom that I think I want back for Americans. The freedom to be able to, you know, take a stroll with your kid down the sidewalk and not have to worry about whether someone's going to shoot up a neighborhood. And we're going to get there, but we need to work for it.
Okay, you've heard what we have to say, so now let's hear what you have to say out there in America. There's got to be people who have an opinion of what we've been talking about. So I really encourage you, please call 888-429-5471 or Skype us at BBS Radio 2. So let's hear from you, 888-429-5471.
We're going to take a short break right now and listen to a song by one of my favorite artists, Johnny Cash, The Devil's Right Hand, and we're going to give Kathleen a chance to reload, and we'll be back just a couple of minutes.
Help Stay me with out us. There, America.
Help Kathleen.
Well, about the time my daddy left to fight the big war, saw my first pistol in the general store. In the general store when I was 13, thought it was the finest thing I ever had seen. I asked if I could have one when I grew up. Mama dropped a dozen eggs and she really blew up. She really blew up and I didn't understand. Mama said the...
Hi, we're back. And we're back with Lad Everett from the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence. And we'd like to talk a little bit, Lad, about something that you brought up earlier. And I know even on your website they talk about this. This whole insurrectionist, let's call these people insurrectionists for lack of a better word, feeling that the government is out to get them and having some sort of high-powered weapon gives them a false sense of control, which they really don't have. What can we do? I mean, is there something as a society that we need to do about this to change this sentiment?
Yeah, I mean, I think people who believe in our Constitution, really, truly believe in it, and who believe in the democratic process need to speak very strongly against this idea, which we call the insurrectionist idea. And the insurrectionist idea is basically the bedrock belief of the modern pro-gun movement, and it's the belief that there is an individual right under the Second Amendment essentially to shoot and kill elected officials, police officers, military service members, when an individual personally believes our government has become, quote-unquote, tyrannical. And, you know, this is an unbelievably dangerous proposition. It's totally false. It has no bearing on what our founders truly believed. If you actually read the Constitution, it states right, specifically that one of the primary purposes of the militia is to suppress insurrections, not to foment them,
right,
to suppress them. And furthermore, the only crime defined in the Constitution is the crime of treason. So, you know, this is a totally perverted idea. It degrades the democratic process, too, because if you reach a point where you basically are saying that the idea of political violence is legitimate in our process, then when those people begin to intimidate, threaten, or possibly use violence against our elected officials, the rest of our rights are degraded. Our vote becomes degraded. All our participation in our democracy is degraded by those threats, by that violence. And I think, you know, it's just people who actually believe in our Constitution and the work that our founders did all those years ago need to speak out against that idea.
Well, you know, that it seems particularly important right now. We've just seen in the last few weeks, 2 days ago, 3 days ago, we saw in Washington a poor, disturbed woman who ran her car into the White House, was finally shot on Capitol Hill. A few weeks ago, we saw this guy at the Navy Yard. I'm not sure that they figured out what his motivation yet was, but obviously he had some gripe against government. And just yesterday, I believe it was, the Oregon Police Department released a video of a shootout between an Oregon police officer who stopped a guy for a traffic violation and an army veteran. The two of them just stood out on the pavement and shot each other. And in fact, the Oregon police officer was shot, and the perpetrator was also shot and killed. They found him. He was shot in the chest, and he was later killed. So it seems that this sentiment, anti-government, anti-authority sentiment is growing, and I find it really scary. You know, of all the people I don't want to have guns, those are really the people I don't want to have guns the most. These people that are paranoid and hate the government. Okay, Annie Oakley, go.
Listen. I think the people are seeing the trust of politicians because, quite frankly, I know we know Terry McAuliffe, but I don't think he's the most moral kind of guy. I don't believe a lot of things he says. And I think that goes across the board for a lot of politicians. We're not getting the cream of the crop. We're getting guys who have an agenda. They want to promote their ideas. They want to promote themselves. And they're not really in it for the betterment of the people. They're in the betterment for their own agenda. So I do think that the problem is because we have such really kind of rotten politicians. I mean, you are definitely, I've worked for people that I feel are, you know, people that do work for the better of the community, but there's a lot. You got to agree, there's a lot of guys in there that have one mind, and that's all they're going for. So I think that is why there is such a distrust of the government, that they're not there for the betterment of the people or to understand what we're going through or to help us. They're to help themselves. And in the past, I'd say like 10 years or so, people have just gotten more and more distrusting of the government. And I guess, you know, out here in Arizona, there is a sense, I mean, we deal with a lot of things that are happening that you guys don't in Washington, the drug cartels, you know, the human smuggling and stuff. And so there is a sense of that something's broken down, you know, that there's not that protection out there. You know, and I just understand, I can understand the sentiment of why people are so distrustful. So I don't know, that's not probably the best comet to come back with, but I think is the true comet. And it's sad because that is the way that people see government. They don't trust it, and they have a good reason not to. So when we hear all this bantering going back and forth, when it really comes down to it, I think people say, hey, it's me and me out for myself, just like these guys are. I got to do what I got to do. I want to have a gun to protect myself. There's invasions. You know, I mean, Tucson, there's a lot of crime in Tucson, Arizona, and the police don't respond very quickly because there's not the budget for having a really good police force and that type of thing. So where do you, when you're talking about registration for having a deep, thorough, more background investigation when you want to buy a gun, where is that money going to come from? And what do you cut to fund something like that? Because that's got to be an expensive, even though I agree, I think it's a good policy to follow, but what do you, you know, where do you get the money for that?
Well, before you answer that, lad, let me remind Annie Oakley out there that she and I used to dye tie-dye T-shirts together, okay? And we hated Richard Nixon, and we hated, right? And we hated the authority, but you and I didn't go out and buy a gun. We all we pulled our hair back in ponytails, and we walked out on the National Mall, and
listen,
we protested.
The reason I don't own a gun, is I know that I'm a really passionate person, and if I came across my boyfriend cheating on me, or if I got really mad, I would use it in a passionate way. So I know that I don't need to own a gun because I'm a scaredy cat. And if somebody is outside my window looking in, I'm going to shoot. I don't care. I'm not going to wait for him to break in and kill me. I'm going to shoot him. That's just the bottom line. Anybody's at my front door and I say, you know, who is it? And they don't answer and they're looking at me and they're wearing a black mask. I'm going to shoot him. I'll drag him inside.
You better hope the mailman's not listening to this.
Well, he shouldn't come at 3 a.m. in the morning either.
But what do you say to that, lab? What do you say to the fact that is a reduction in resources to blame for some of the distrust, you think?
Well, look, a couple of things on that. You know, for starters, you have to do a budget via priorities, right? You know, if policing is being under-resourced, you know, one of the first questions, and that's causing a legitimate fear of crime, you know, one of the first questions to elected officials should be why? You know, why is law enforcement not getting the money it needs to perform its job? Because there's, you know, I would argue that there's probably no tasks that our government handles that's more important than protecting the community. So, you know, that's one of the things. But then, you know, my second question would be if your government, state, local, federal government is under-resourced, why is that the case? And are the people who are making our government under-resourced the same people who are telling you you need guns to protect yourself? And I think in that's a general statement, obviously, but I think in most cases it's true. I think, you know, if you look at people who are, you know, lowering taxes to the point where, you know, governments don't have the resources they once had, or, in this case now shutting down the federal government, in many cases, these are people who are conservatives who do not believe in adequately resourcing government, and in some cases, not letting it operate at all. So, you know, these are things where if you don't think the police are protecting you, vote. Vote right. Don't vote for the guy who you don't trust, who's a jerk, who's corrupt. Vote for someone who actually believes in the job that he or she is going to be doing. You know, right now in this country, we tend to vote a lot of people into our legislators who hate government. I would argue that that's a profoundly bad start for someone to become a public servant.
Well, and when you say the government, the priority of government is to protect the people, also a priority of government, and I think of the founding fathers, well established by the founding fathers, is that the rule of law is what's important. It's really not up to us to protect ourselves in a democracy as much as it is to follow the law and to rely on the law. And it's funny when you talk, lad, about the people that in the government shutdown, lots of those Capitol police officers who protected the guys that brought this about last week were supposed to be furloughed. So it's true. I don't think that a lot of the guys on Capitol Hill, a lot of men and women on Capitol Hill that support these positions really have the best interests of the people at heart.
Well, you know, just to bring up kind of on that subject of protecting yourself, I mean, you probably all remember Bernard Goetz in New York City, who was the, you know, the weak kind of nerdy guy who was on the subway all the time, totally getting, you know, harangued and bothered and threatened. And finally, four young black kids tried to mug him, and he was carrying a gun, and he shot them all. And I think, you know, it actually paralyzed one of them. And, you know, it was interesting because the jury did not charge him. I mean, he was brought up for, I think, attempted murder, assault, reckless endangerment, but the jury found him not guilty of all charges except carrying an unlicensed firearm. And it was kind of one of those turning points where people were so fed up with the New York City police. They weren't protecting anyone. Things got, you know, started to get better. They started to fund it. But then also, I think the NRA used that as a time to loosen the restrictions on carrying firearms, if I'm correct. So I guess a lot of people still hold on to that kind of feeling, you know, that the gun kind of levels the playing field. When it's you against four muggers, you know, do I have a right to carry a gun to protect myself? I mean, what would you say to that person?
I think the pro-gun movement kind of speaks out of both sides of its mouth on that one. To some degree, you know, on the left hand, you know, they'll tell you, you know, and Wayne LaPierre will give a speech and say the words rapists and robbers probably 80 times, right? You know, to make it sound, I mean, he once gave a speech in the District of Columbia and literally told people, as soon as you walk out that door, your life is under danger. You know, he was speaking in downtown D.C. where I work. I mean, it was just ludicrous. Yeah. On the other hand, when it fits their arguments, the pro-gun movement will be the first people to tell you that violent crime has been steadily declining in this country for 15 or 20 years, right? So which is which is the reality? Is there a rapist about to jump through your window, or we are living in a society where violent crime is down? You know, it's like I can never quite tell which, you know, it's whatever's convenient at the moment. So, you know, I think the bottom line is, you know, you raised the case of Bernie Goetz. I think the bottom line is, you know, we need to determine, are we going to be safer in a society where a guy opens fire on a subway train, you know, against kids holding screwdrivers who want $5-$10 from him? I don't know. Maybe we will. That's a good debate to have. You know, let's have that debate. I think another point in New York City, obviously, is, though, is that, you know, New York City is gun laws have been toughened significantly since that time. That's now one of the safest major cities in the country. And New York as a state has, like, you know, the fourth or fifth lowest rate of gun deaths in the entire country because of their good gun laws. So, you know, let's have this debate. Let's have a vigorous debate, but let's have an informed debate with all the facts on the table.
Well, and this is an argument that Kathleen and I keep having too, lad. And I don't think you can use anecdotal stuff to just make these decisions, anecdotal information, because there's always going to be cases. There's always going to be that one person that protects themselves with a gun and is glad they had a gun. But when you look at the statistics, isn't it true that you're more likely to be killed by somebody that you know with a gun than by a stranger? And don't we lose more family members and due to accidents with guns then we lose citizens and armed robberies and things like that? It seems to me that when you're making national policy decisions, you really got to look at the statistics and not at the individual cases, you know, and because there's an anecdotal story on each side. You know, if you look at George Zimmerman, this is one of the scariest laws, I think, in America, the stand your ground law. And if you look at Zimmerman, what would have happened that night if he hadn't had a gun? If he hadn't had a gun, there'd be a kid that went home with a soda and a bag of candy in his pocket, and he'd be alive right now, and Zimmerman's life wouldn't be destroyed right now. But so it seems to me that you can find a story on either side, regardless of which side you're looking at.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, just real quick, if you look at FBI Uniform Crime Report data, you know, something like 78% or 79% of homicides involve people who know each other already, and, you know, one out of every four involve family members. And then, you know, if you look at their, you know, circumstances, relationship type descriptions of these homicides, something like 40% of homicides, you know, erupt from simple arguments over, like, property, money, or relationships. So, you know, this notion that it's always going to be this masked rapist, jumping through your window is just not statistically true.
Well, let me take it on another line. What do you say, or what are your feelings about hunters and their use of guns? I mean, a lot of people out here are avid hunters and feel that, you know, this would be another way of taking away their right to be able to hunt.
I have never worked a day in my life in my 13 years in this movement on the issue of hunting. I have no issue with people hunting. I think hunting, unlike general gun ownership, is actually pretty well regulated, you know, mm-hmm. Particularly at the state level. It's a very regulated activity in terms of safety. I think the NRA has beat back on that a little bit, but, you know, that's not where the NRA makes its bread and butter. But, you know, in terms of a guy going out hunting, you know, bringing your kids out, you know, teaching them that tradition, I have no issue with that whatsoever. That's not why I'm doing this.
Well, and, you know, when I was a teenager, I used to hunt. Let me point out before animal advocates call in that I was such a bad shot that I never actually hit anything. But I remember I had to have a license. I was out there. I had to check in. I was on regulated land where people I had to, if I had shot a deer or something else, I would have had to report it to a game warden. There were people that patrolled the area. I was only allowed to use a shotgun because I did it in Pennsylvania, which was a populated area, and long rifles even back then had been banned. So it is very regulated. There's a license required. The land is if you hunt on public land, it's very regulated.
Well, so
So
coming away from this conversation, I guess what I would say is, if someone said, well, what happened on the talk show? I would say that your organization believes in allowing people to have a gun if they have really good if you can instill really or regulate it by having really good background checks, that you're not against people owning guns. You just want to make sure that those who own them don't have any kind of mental issues, don't have any kind of like family violence in their background or any activity like that. Is that correct?
Yeah, but it's a bigger problem than that. You know, like, for example, the one consumer product our government can't regulate for safety and health is guns, real guns. If you make a toy gun in this country that doesn't even fire anything, the government can create a list of standards to make that product safe for the market, safe for consumer use. The real guns are the one product that's exempt. I don't think it should be that way. There's also practically no laws on the books that would protect children in the home from guns. So, for example, there are almost no safe storage provisions mandated in our law in terms of how you store a gun in the home when you own kids. There are very few states that have criminal accountability for parents when their guns are accessed by people who aren't supposed to have them. There's a lot of different things we have to do, but there's not anything we have to do that would prevent someone who's willing to go through a thorough background check from owning a firearm, someone who is truly law-abiding and truly mentally stable. There's nothing that could or should prevent someone like that from being able to own firearms.
Well, that's really interesting, because that's the first time I've heard anyone who's kind of, I don't know what you would call yourself. I don't think you would call yourself anti-gun. Right? Because it sounds like you're not.
I'm not. I've gone and shot them.
So
I'm not scared of firearms. I can see why people enjoy doing that.
So and that's a very good point. And I think that's a thing that you guys really have to do a better way of getting that message out. And because I'm not, you know, I'm kind of like in the middle. I understand that there's places and there's areas that people need to have a gun and they have a right. I don't want people to have guns in New York City, where I lived for 20 years. But I don't seem to have gotten that message from, you know, and I don't know what to call the other side, the anti-gun side, you know. And maybe there are different levels and organizations have different beliefs. There are people who say no guns should be allowed. But from what you're saying, I can see that there could be a compromise. And I think that's why we wanted to have this conversation, to really hear what your organization is and what it's about. And it's good to know that you are not against guns. You just want better laws and regulating who gets them. Would that be a good, correct way?
Yeah, it's correct. But look, we need to push back a little against brainwashing. You know, there's no issue in the entire body American politic where we see an issue in absolutist terms. where we honestly believe that we can either do absolutely nothing or we're going to lose the, you know, this right altogether. We just don't see any other issue that way. The NRA is purposely making us see this issue to basically have the gun industry operate in a laissez-faire manner where there's no regulation and profits are through the roof. The NRA doesn't give a damn whether the person buying the next gun is Aaron Alexis or Jared Loughner or the most law-abiding, mentally stable guy in the entire country. They don't care. I can't emphasize that enough. So, yeah. You know, people need to be a little bit more intellectually rigorous and challenge some of these things. Because, you know, ask yourself, do you think like this about any other issue? Of course you don't. It's just not how we settle problems in this country. Our democratic process allows us to meet in the middle and compromise. And I'll tell you right now, let me make this clear. To us, compromise is not a dirty word. Compromise is how we have gained our greatest victories as a country in terms of making good policy. And that's how we should solve this problem, too.
Exactly.
Well, and that seems to be a real problem, is that the other side doesn't want to compromise because they think any compromise is a capitulation. And that's a real problem, I think. And I think that we all have to come together and say, look, if you want to have a gun, if you want to protect yourself, whatever the issue is, you can have those things. But we need to keep our children straight. We need to stop the kind of things that happen in Connecticut where babies are shot by a mentally, I mean, which one of us, no matter whether you have a gun or not, how you believe in this, which one of us wouldn't have wanted to stop what happened in Newtown, regardless of how you feel about it? We need to be able to keep our children safe, and we need to, you know, like you said earlier, lad, be able to walk down the street. We're all parents here. We all worry about these things, and so we need to reach a compromise. And you know what? This is a discussion that we have to continue. You know, when you talk about keeping guns safe at home, there are a lot of other issues. Like, I wish we had time. We're running out of time here, but I wish we had time to talk about Heller, which you well know was the decision that struck down the gun laws in the District of Columbia, based on us trying to develop a law that would keep children in the home safe.
I understand, but you know, Senator Brown, when you talk about compromise, it almost also means from your end, because when we have these big discussions, you don't seem to have that compromising type of attitude towards guns. Would you say?
I've known you for a very long time, and I don't want you to have a gun. And I'm going to ask Glad to sponsor. I'm going to ask him to sponsor the Kathleen Gomez Can't Have Gun Law. That's the next thing. No, I think you're right, Kathleen, to a certain extent. I think we tend to push back, and I think there are people out there that think guns in general are a bad thing. But I don't think groups like LADS and other groups that are on the Handgun Control Inc. and the major groups involved in the movement are against guns. They want to make a safe environment. I believe that.
Well, I do believe that what you say is right. The NRA has done a very good way of making people feel this is, you know, it's either you can have your guns, but anything else is going to be bureaucracy that eventually just takes you right away. And, you know, when you talk about all the additional laws, like, you know, things about making sure that parents, you know, have safely stored their guns, then they'll come in and talk about the bureaucracy of the federal government, and it's just going to be keep on going, more laws and laws passed. What are you going to throw the parents in jail, you know, because, and I, as a gun owner, my father always had, you know, his guns away, and I was taught how to use it, and I was taught that it was something that was very deadly and nothing to be played with and that kind of thing. But, you know, it's something that we have to keep on talking about, and I think compromise is the right way. I feel better knowing that you're not against guns, and you do see that certain areas are different, locations are different. New York City is much different than being out on a ranch in Arizona, so you can't compare the two, and you can't have something that's just, you know, one fit fits all or one, you know, mold fits all. So that is the kind of conversation I think people who fear your group need to hear more about.
Yes, and we're out of time here, but I want to thank Ladd Everett for being with us. I hope he'll come back again. I also want to tell – thanks. And I also want to tell you, and correct me if I'm wrong here, Ladd, that if you want to get involved with Ladd's organization, which is a great organization, go to csgv.org, csgv.org on the net, and you can find them. You'll be able to contribute and see the good work that they're doing. I hope you all tune in next week. We've invited the National Rifle Association.
Yes, to we send, have.
Yes, to send a representative. Now, we don't know whether they will or not, but we do want to hear both sides of the story. And we thank you so much, Ladd, for being with us. And we hope that you'll come back and join us again sometime.
You were very eloquent.
I really enjoyed the discussion. It was a great conversation.
Well, you're very eloquent. Thank you. I'm glad to know that Senator Brown has such educated friends in D.C. as you. Makes me feel better about him.
Thank you.
All right. We'll see you. Thank you, Kathleen. And we'll see all of you next week, hopefully. We know you're out there. Start calling in because we want to hear what you have to say.
This is Annie Oakley signing off.
Yeah. This is the guy that's hiding from Annie Oakley signing off.
Bye-bye.
We'll see you
Thank
next
you,
week.
Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote.